We're moving in at last then.
Looks like it.
Bad news, I'm afraid.
They're old. They get bad news every week.
This is the Extra Hot Crate Podcast, episode 391 for the week of July 24th, 2022.
July?
What July? Did I say July?
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's just do it. I am train station grifter, Mr. Cole. I am here with player in the great game, Mrs. Bunting.
Striver? I hardly even know her.
Dull enough to be respectable, Mrs. Ariano.
Hi.
And in-home ballroom booking agent, Mr. Lazanti.
No one can keep Pumpkin under control.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for a week in the future.
It is really cold for July, guys. I was
it really is. Climate change, am I right?
You know what's good about this podcast is that when I'm gone from this earth, this will be a great audio record of my quick decline as I make dumber and dumber mistakes every week to the point where I'm going to like mispronounce my name, forget what this is, what's a podcast. Yeah. Enjoy, everybody.
Before we get into this episode and further mistakes from Dave, we want to apologize for last week, which was not a mistake by Dave. If you tuned in expecting to hear us talking to Jordan Searles about How I Met Your Father, we did record that episode, and then it turned out what we recorded was not usable because of some kind of...
some electronic interference of some sort.
Yeah, something weird happened. We weren't able to use her track, but we will try and book her again soon. We apologize. So that's why you got Mustache Thunderdome, which we had pre-recorded back in September.
Yeah,
just in case of such an emergency.
Apologies and note to Lara, Tomka, and Santiago, who provided content for that episode. We will get all that back into the mix one way or another.
And now for this episode, you've read his work at Defamer and Grantland, and you've heard him on this podcast. It's Mark Lazanti. Mark Lazanti!
I just raised my hands like people could see me. The Zoom is really messing with my head.
We are here to talk about The Gilded Age.
Quite.
It's a TV setting at once familiar and unfamiliar, New York City, in 1882. On one side of East 61st Street, old money sisters Ada Brooke, Cynthia Nixon, and Agnes Van Rien, Christine Baranski, prepare to open their home to their niece Marion, Louisa Jacobson. By the way, trying to fool us all by using her middle name, her actual last name is fucking Gummer.
Yeah.
Nice
and it's
try.
Secret so Gummer.
Obvious. My notes were like, who is this poor man's Gummer? And then I was like, oh, this is actually a regular Gummer.
It's the other one. Anyway. Marion's father's recent death has left her penniless, which is why she has to move in with her aunts. Meanwhile, across the street, the Russells, who've made their brand new money in finance and trains and shit, are finally moving in across the street after the lengthy construction of their Stanford White designed home. Mrs. Russell strives her very hardest to break into New York society without eating shit. Marion just tries to get along with everyone in all social strata, and all the servants in both households judge everyone and each other. Who will make it in this future concrete jungle where dreams are made of? If this all sounds a lot like Downton Abbey, that's because the show is from the same creator, Julian Fellowes. Let's do the Chen check-in and go around the circle. Mark, quickly, should our listeners watch The Gilded Age?
Let's say yes, if you're a fellowhead especially.
Okay. Sarah?
Yes, but, and I'll get into it.
Yeah. That's where I am too, I think. Dave?
Well, first of all, I would say, Mark, you should have went with if you're part of the fellowship, I believe is what that group is called.
I think I have like 10 different ones here, and that's just the one that I remember.
Okay, so no if you want Downton Abbey, yes if you just want period eye candy for an hour.
It's pretty close to Downton Abbey as far as the minute you turn it on, it looks exactly like Downton Abbey. It's like the same shots, establishing shots, the same like quality of that, maybe even amped up a little bit with all this like extra HBO money that got pumped into it. But it definitely had that like HBO on Masterpiece feel when it starts. It's the swelling strings and it's, you know, it's the carriages scooting by and it's people in very elaborate fucked up hats. shout out Jay Kang for that. But if somehow you came to the show and you weren't a Downton Abbey fan,
yeah,
you're getting a lot of the same Fellows dopamine hits from this thing. And also other ways it does fall short. Like some of the characterizations, we'll get deeper into that. Like doesn't have maybe as much meat on the bone so far.
Yeah.
As far as that goes. And it's a little bit of a different setup because it takes place in New York in the 1880s. And it's sort of a, I mean, it's on the wrong continent, but prequel time-wise of what's going on, you know, in the Downton universe.
Right.
Isn't this just a year after the Yellowstone prequel?
Before.
Yeah, it's 18. No, this before. Is a year before. Isn't it 1882?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's 1883 in the Taylor Sheridan verse.
See, for me, this show, I was saying to Tara when we're watching it, feels like Downton feels like the reaction to this type of show, this type of look at it, like Gilded Age, Howard's End, Room with a View, like all these, like, here, what's the news of London? That Downton Abbey took that and sort of made it accessible in a way that I feel like this isn't. There's no like comedy undertones to this in the same way that Downton Abbey has. And I feel like that's what got me into Downton Abbey was the ludicrousness of it all. And this doesn't have that alchemy for me. And I feel like if you watch this 100 years in the future, I would have guessed Gilded Age came first and then Downton Abbey came after. But it's actually the other way around.
Yeah, on Salon, I think it was someone, the headline was, it's more like Dynasty than Downton Abbey. And it was like, no, Downton was more like Dynasty than this. Like, this feels much more straight ahead, as Dave said. Whereas, like, Downton, what made it fun was that it had more of a twist.
It was
like
soapier, for sure.
It had soap tropes with this fancy pants setting, and that was what made it special.
The second episode, which is not available to the general public yet, had a little bit more of that, but just like a little bit. Like not enough to really make me want to compare it with Downton, but Christine Baranski has some moments in the second episode that kind of reminded me a little bit of the curtness of like the dowager.
Yeah, totally. Kind of thing. Well, we'll get into the actresses more, but I'm going to throw to Sarah. They're obviously starting at a deficit for you by making the choice not to include a character who shares your first and last name. But on the other hand, Carrie Coon.
Well, yes, Carrie Coon. And also, like, I was immersed in Edith Wharton as a matter of academic course for like 7 formative years. So this is all very familiar in a good way for me.
Yeah.
But there are certain points where it's like, why didn't you just adapt The House of Mirth or The Age of Innocence as a series or The Custom of the Country or like, but you know, there's a ton of Wharton, including a lot of really good ghost stories. And she also wrote erotica, whatever. She had a wide, you know, she had a wide horizon, but there's processy stuff in here that was appealing about Downton that is also appealing about this, and that Wharton just like sort of does on the page, that after you get done constantly consulting the dictionary for like 20 pages, like, what the fuck is ormolu? It's painted porcelain, AMA. Then you sort of are accustomed to like watching them take ice out of a truck with hooks or an actual red carpet being unrolled and the tools that are used for that. I found that very like visually nourishing. Mm-hmm. I love to look at it. I love this sort of Whartonian milieu. Even though the whole point of Wharton's rendering of it is how fucking stifling it is for everyone, especially a woman of her station. But everything about this, like the uptight aunt who married into an old, like Dutch New Amsterdam family, the aphorizing by Mrs. Baranski about, you know, change is bad. I'm not interested in facts if they conflict with my beliefs. Like that, it's very Downton.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of winking, especially since there is a black character. There is a lot of like almost cheating to camera. Like, we are investigating these stories. Look at us investigating these stories. Like, I don't think it's that surface and fake. And that actor actually had an interview with, I think, Glamour or Good Housekeeping. I will find it and we'll put it in the show notes, about how she had to go to the showrunners and be like, there's a bunch of white men born in the 80s writing my, the experience of my ancestors. And that's not going to work for me as well as it could. And I think that ball was moved somewhat. She's giving a great performance, obviously, but there's a lot here that's like, I'm not sure there's necessarily any larger point to watching this. It's just like pleasing to the eye.
Yeah.
And for someone who has spent as much time as she has with Lily Bart and Newland Archer and all of those people, it's on a frequency that I hear definitely, but it's also like, why didn't you just use Wharton? She did win a Pulitzer for this stuff. Like, I don't know. Anyway, that's where I'm at with it. I don't think it's poorly done, but it's like, you know, the first episode is really like, you look at it and you're like 80 minutes of just like silver being polished. This is a lot. So your mileage may vary.
And hats.
And fucked up hats. So many hats, and they are so fucked up.
There's a hat that looks like an upside down turkey.
Yes! Dave said the same thing.
And I freeze framed it. I was like, is that actually an upside down turkey hat?
Yes. Yep.
And my conclusion was, yes, it is.
I thought they were supposed to be like birds facing each other.
It just needed those little chef hats at the end, yes, and it would have been perfect. Yeah.
Okay, but speaking of the Wharton of it all, I mean, I feel like anyone should be able to tell any story they want, but I sort of felt like a British person who is Julian Fellowes' age is not going to get inside a story about like the desperation of trying to make class mobility happen than an American. Did you, Mark, feel like it should have been more of an American story, or did that bug you?
You know, the big ask they're making here is, you know, the central conflict is, and what they're asking you to pick a side on, I guess, is the old money or the new money.
Right.
You know, it's like, oh, well, fuck you. It's
exactly.
Like, who cares? It's entertaining enough for that, but it's, you know, in this day and age, if this is what the central conflict is really going to be, you know, it's just going to be background noise. You know, it's like, you're putting it on because it's pleasant to watch and whatever, but it's not going to be incredibly thought-provoking on that part. It's like, as amazing as Carrie Coon is, you know, 90% of her plot is, no one will come to my party, and how are we going to make them?
It's true.
You know, I've watched the first two episodes, and that is the through line of both of them.
Yeah.
It's slightly different.
There's a scene where she's really angry about it in her bed, and it is pretty fucking funny.
It is.
How overacted it is. I kind of loved it. Like, more of that is what this show needs, frankly. It needs to either get funnier or campier or something. Like, I want more out of the ludicrous parts of the story.
Yeah.
And so far, it's not quite delivering, like, the volume isn't high enough on those things for me. But it is, like, as Mark said, the hats are fun to look at.
So we already called her out for trying to hide who she is. Fucking Jacobson. Fuck out of here. But I get the idea of having an outsider character come in so everyone can, like, exposit shit around her. This is, like, a very standard TV thing to do, and that was sort of the function of Matthew Crawley and Downton at first. But Marion is very boring to me. Anyone else?
She's boring, and she acclimates really quickly. So that's like that whole thing is like, well, how long is that actually going to happen? How long are we supposed to actually be, you know, see the world through her eyes when she's like, oh, this is great. I'm kind of rich now, and I have this big house, and I really don't have to do anything except sell baked goods at a charity sale. Like, that's a pretty good life.
Yes.
It beats that $30 inheritance she got.
Yeah.
And she's got a lawyer who's interested in her. Ooh.
Well, the lawyer's not good enough.
No, he's trash. He's got a job, Sarah. He's pure garbage.
I know. Although, like, all of the heroes, so to say, in Wharton are also lawyers. They just don't do anything.
Right.
They just, like, make sure it's technically legal to move a bunch of grain around. She doesn't concern herself with those trifles, nor should she necessarily, because that's not what everyone's there for. Mm-hmm. I think that for, like, you know, for British showrunners to dive into this story, like, New York society was still at that time extremely preoccupied with continental execution. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple would get married and then the wife would have her wedding dress remade, and then there was a certain order in which, like, sashes were moved around, and then they would debut at the opera in Paris. And I mean, I think that to be American was still, or and I guess it still is, kind of a black mark in terms of your cultural worth. So this section of New York, I don't really have a problem with him, with them diving into that. But if they are really going to sort of try to be broader, like Wharton at least doesn't pretend to know what anyone besides the 0.01% are doing or pretend that she cares.
Right.
So that's where they may run.
How do these oysters get to my plate? Doesn't matter.
No, right. Doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's another way the show could have gone where like Peggy could have been the POV character. Like maybe Marion was passing through on her way to Albany or something. And like Peggy just lands up at the house and stays. And then she's our POV person, which like that might have been richer. But the fact that she's staying, I guess, is, you know, enough. Mm-hmm. But let's talk about the older actresses, the not fake Gummer one or real Gummer, fake Jacobson, because they all of them understood the assignment. Mm-hmm. Katie Finneran, Kelly O'Hara, Jean Triplehorn, fucking Donna Murphy as Mrs. Astor. And then we've already mentioned Baranski, Nixon, and Kuhn. Who is your fave, Mark?
It's got to be Kuhn.
I got to go with Nixon. I like what Nixon was doing.
Baranski is like, you get the feeling like they haven't thrown enough of the raw dowager meat to Baranski yet. She has little moments. Mm-hmm. It's very clearly supposed to be an analog of that character.
Yes.
You know, she gets a little bit here and there. And I imagine as the show goes on, there'll be more of that.
Yeah.
But, you know, the parts of it that are funniest are, like I said earlier, is the nobody will come to my party and I'm going to make them pay. That stuff is kind of great. And Carrie Coon is, you know, really sinking her teeth into it.
She's absolutely
one of the best actresses on the planet. Who does she replace? She was supposed to be.
I don't remember. Let me look it up.
Someone else great, too, I believe, but it was not.
Amanda Pete. Ooh, that also would have been great.
Oh, no, that's a heartbreaker because she would have been very good in this, too, I think. Mm-hmm. Very brittle. It would be a very different performance, though, for sure. I'm with Dave. I think that Nixon, like, I love them all. Obviously, the Baransk is almost always my favorite and Carrie Coon, XO. But what Nixon is getting to do with this, like after, you know, and just like that, after like having run for governor of this state as an out person is like, this is just fascinating to watch. And sometimes you can see her thinking as an actor, like, how am I going to be in this situation? Because it's completely off tone from everything that I'm known for.
Yeah.
And this is also someone who was in a, you know, legendary Law and Order episode as basically Bernadette Getz. So there are a lot of signifiers on her. And she is also the one who is coming the closest to not walking in a way that is too modern. That she's just sort of like kicking the bustle out from behind her in a very natural way. Whereas Carrie Coon just looks like, I don't know, she just got off a horse like that. That's fine. Maybe that's old money's problem with her, but
it kind of fits though, right? Because Carrie Coon, like being the new money, like she's all like, if she's walking in her head, she's doing dance steps in order to do the old money dance. It kind of makes sense. I mean, I kind of buy it. The one thing I like about Nixon's performance though, is she reminds me of my British aunt, that she sort of has scatterbrain wisdom. Like, she is kind of useless, but also wise. And my aunt is like that. Like, she'll send Christmas gifts 9 months late and not really realize it. But, like, she's also, like, very worldly and, like, has been around the block a few times. And I kind of like that about her. Like, she had sort of, like, one foot in this sort of world of Julian Fellowes. But also, I feel like she is bringing something to the performance that he didn't perhaps intend, which is like this kind of modern humanizing element. And it's sort of like a bridge between like then and now that I feel like her character feels good.
Yeah. And if we run her through the Downton to Gilded Converter, she's maybe the Cora, right? Like at least partially like the decent person. She's nicer than the rest. It's not a perfect analogy, but.
Well, Cora was new money too.
She's Cora with like a lemon squeeze of Edith.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like the running joke that Baranski has about a character, like, oh, I'm going to outlive you, is pretty funny. And I feel like that sort of like kick the dog character trait has got, you know, it's got some Edith DNA on it.
Yeah. And every time Nixon is like, anyway, I mean, I think she as an actor is covering the greatest distance between where we as the audience start with her as an actor to this character. And it's pretty cool to watch. It's, I mean, this isn't going to be for everyone, the Gilded Age, but it's pretty interesting to see what they're doing with through the first two episodes, which is all I've seen. Mm-hmm. It's like, there's not much going on, but like, that's Warden's New York for you. Like,
right. Well,
they're just sitting around talking about the edging on visiting cards and being scandalized by it. And then they go to bed at sundown.
They do seem to be seeding some potential future shit in terms of Oscar, the surprise secret gay. We find out that he's fucking John Quincy Adams' grandson. Because there's more than once that we hear he's the one who's going to inherit the whole estate. And it's going to be his responsibility to take care of Ada if Agnes does not outlive her. And Agnes is very like, whatever about it, considering that they kind of went through it with their own brother. Like, you would think she would have more safeguards in place. So that's why I'm wondering, like, is he going to be the Madame Olenska, like, ruined character? Because it comes out that he's fucking guys.
Right. And is he fucking the watcher from Fringe, Cerferus?
Oh, that guy, right.
Because that guy definitely had some whiz for this maid who was trying to get some Russell bastard money for herself.
Yeah, right.
But he's like, I wouldn't. And it's like, because you already tried it? Okay. And I don't think it was with any of the ladies at the house.
Yeah.
It's just a theory.
Well, here's my list of Julian Fellowes ideas that are repeating here. Brunette housemaids not to be trusted. You've already mentioned the one who's trying to fuck Mr. Russell. Mm-hmm. Nothing's more important than doing what's expected of you. Sometimes people are gay. Mean old bitches get the best lines. It is a changing world, right?
Oh, no, change. How will the Americans deal with the toaster?
And it's important to how will Americans deal with the toaster? And it's important to have a cute dog in the foreground.
This one's less cute than the one in Downton, though. I think we can all agree.
Isis butt forever.
It's watchable. It's very watchable, but it's just not the same vibe as Downton Abbey. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's trying to be. That's the thing. Like, I would give the show the benefit of the doubt if it wasn't so obviously Downton Abbey, but...
Yes.
Yeah, it's Wharton Abbey.
You know what I mean? Like, sometimes it feels unfair to say, like, oh, it's not like Downton Abbey. Like, of course it isn't. But guys, it's trying to be.
Well, that's the thing. Like, in terms of Baranski not being full Dowager Countess yet, it does feel to me like he's trying to not have that accusation slung at him. You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to pull her back so that people don't say, it's the same thing over. Just be the same thing again. We liked it. It's a success for a reason.
Guy. Just be a one-trick pony is what we all want. Just do it.
Yeah. It's a good trick.
Yeah, it is a really beautiful trick, and we enjoyed watching it for a long time, and not just because you named shit after us and tricked us into it. I mean, I heard.
Yeah. Miss Sarah Bunting.
What on earth is she doing here?
Nothing good.
It is time to go around the dial talking about things we've been watching on TV lately. Our first stop is with Tara.
Yes, it is time to learn about some new sitcoms. First, American Auto is the follow-up from Justin Spitzer, who created Superstore. And whereas that show was about idiots and C-suites making idiotic decisions that would roll downhill to low-wage workers they would never know or understand, American Auto is about the C-suite idiots themselves. Anna Gasteyer plays Catherine Hastings, who has just taken over as the new CEO of Payne Motors. But the gag is her last job was CEO of a pharmaceutical company, and she doesn't know anything about cars at all. And the rest of her team are all holdovers from the old regime, so they're trying to stay on track with projects that were in progress before she got there. And Catherine wants to put her stamp on stuff so she looks like she's effective, whether her ideas make any sense or are practical or not. And in addition to the obstructionist boss, there's your typical mix of people you meet in an office workplace sitcom. A type A lady, an out-of-touch guy, a persnickety guy, a quirky assistant. But in the course of the pilot, someone else joins the team, and without spoiling it, he brings a different energy to the group. And also, John Barinholtz from Superstore, he played Marcus, the guy who lived in the walls for a while, is also around as Wesley Payne, a descendant of the company's original founders, who is completely useless and may not even have a job as such at all. There are a lot of jokes at his and his family's expense that suggest the original Payne was politically not very different from Henry Ford, which is to say racist. Ooh. And much as on Superstore, the jokes are often a lot harder than you might necessarily expect on a network sitcom. It's on NBC. And I appreciate that while every story definitely has a dummy, it's not the same people being dumb in the same way all the time in every episode. And it's not as good as Superstore yet. That's on the basis of watching all the screeners that were available as of the holidays. And I'm pretty sure that's the whole season. It was 8 episodes. But Superstore took a while to totally find its footing also. And I hope American Auto gets a chance to continue getting sharper. Also, it stars that one office building that you've already seen in Homecoming. The first, as we talked with Mark about many years ago. McMillions, Amazon's Utopia, Space Force, Mythic Quest, others. Dave, you also watched American Auto. What are your thoughts?
It's a tougher sell because it's almost the same problem as the Gilded Age.
True. Yeah.
It's the kind of the 1% at the top POV rather than workers down at the bottom of the employment chain. It is funny. It's not quite as sharp as Superstore, just because I think it's easier to relate and write about the things that happen to people in Superstore than it is to upper management stuff. Doesn't quite hit the same way, but it's smart. It's got things in each episode that you're going to laugh at, but it's not going to be as big of a hit as Superstore.
I hope it gets to get to a second season, because I feel like that's when a lot of these shows really find their footing. Like Parks and Rec, The Office, same thing.
I wouldn't be surprised if he finds a way to superstorize it in a future season.
Yeah.
Where
we see more of the plant.
Yeah.
And I also want to talk about Abbott Elementary. I think we were all sad that Quinta Brunson did not return for season 2 of A Black Lady Sketch Show, but she had a good reason creating and starring in this new sitcom on ABC. Full disclosure, our friend Brian Rubenstein, who I used to do the Married at First Sight podcast Bride and Doom with, is also a co-executive producer on the show. He wrote last week's episode as well, New Tech, which was very funny. I swear, Brian's participation does not affect my strong recommendation. Quinta Brunson plays Janine, an almost brand new second grade teacher at this elementary school in Philadelphia, one of the poorest in the country. And she and one other teacher, whose name is Jacob, are the only ones who came back after their first year out of teacher's college, because this job is hard. The rest of the cast, the great Lisa Ann Walter from The Parent Trap, she played Chessie, as Melissa, another second grade teacher who apparently has mob ties. She gets a bunch of furnishing in the pilot from family members and connections who are working on a new Eagles stadium. Like, the big triumph of the pilot is getting a new rug for Janine's classroom, and they unroll it and it's got a giant Eagles logo on it, which is very funny. The great Cheryl Lee Ralph is Barbara, a kindergarten teacher. Their completely batshit principal, Janelle James, her name is Ava. While everyone else in the cast is hilarious, I really hope the show makes Janelle James a superstar. She is so funny. And after an incident in the pilot, one other teacher is relieved of duty and replaced by Gregory, who's played by Tyler James Williams. He was more recently in The Walking Dead, but you might know him as Chris from Everybody Hates Chris. He wants to be a principal.
Oh my God. We're so old.
I know. He wants to be a principal. He applied to be the principal at this school, but we're given to understand Ava did some shenanigans to get the job herself. Recently, I saw the show compared to Parks and Rec. I do think there will be a lot of crossover between their audiences, but Abbott Elementary has a much less sunny outlook on what it's like and what it means to, you know, be a public servant. The pilot actually went so hard on how dire the issues are at the school and for its students that it feels like they've pulled back a little bit since then to make it less bleak. It's not unbleak. A recent episode revolves around the demeaning contortions that teachers have to go through to solicit donations just so that students can have, like, scissors and crayons. Dark premise, certainly based on reality, but they find the funny in it. And I really can't say enough about how strong the ensemble is. It feels like they've been working together forever in the best way. Great jokes, judicious deployment of kid actors help make Janelle James extremely famous. Watch this show. They both air on Tuesday nights. If you're a cord-cutting pinko, they're also on Hulu. And they've each only aired a few episodes, so you can definitely catch up from the beginning. Very good shows. for my plugs, I wrote about the CW's new unscripted show about a marching band. Yes, I am in favor of it. You can find that at Decider. And this is slightly old now, but I also interviewed Christina Ricci about Yellow Jackets and other stuff. And that is at GQ.com. We will link both of those in the show notes.
Mark, what do you have for us today?
Well, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I like TV for the escapism. Watching a show about a situation, you know, totally different than this world. Everything just gets worse and worse and darker, and every seeming solution quickly devolves into a new kind of elaborate and absurd misery.
We get it. You watch The Masked Singer.
Talking about the fourth season of Ozark, part one, which just debuted on Netflix Friday, I think. As I was tearing through them, I didn't realize at first it had escaped me that it was only part one of the end. So I was racing through them, and then I got finally to episode seven. There were seven that are posted, and I was like, boy, it seems like they're going to have a lot of stuff to wrap up in this one episode. And then I was like, oh. They really reeled me in.
Some money heist shit.
I have to make a confession. I love grim TV shows.
Okay, that's fine.
The grimmer, the better, for all those reasons. Like, I watched all of Mayor of Kingstown. That might be the grimmest show ever. And Ozark is getting to the end and very fraught situation where the birds, played by Jason Bateman, and the perfect Laura Linney, who should win every award for this and for everything going forward, trying to, you know, if you, the premise being they had to escape Chicago to go to the Ozarks to launder money for a drug cartel.
Right. As you do.
And the increasingly insane machinations of trying to, if we just do this one more thing for the drug lord, we're going to get out. Yeah. He's going to let us return to our lives. And it just, I'll tell you what, it just keeps going. They just, every time they get close, somebody gets killed, or four or five people get killed, or the heroin crop next door gets lit on fire or whatever. They get captured and brought to Mexico with bags on their heads. And flown back in private jets and redeposited into their Ozark. They're opening casinos motels to launder the money. I love it. I can't get enough. Be upset when it's gone, because there'll be a little less misery on tap at Netflix.
I remember when Adam Sternberg was on talking about it, he just said, like, look, guys, I like Breaking Bad, and sometimes I just want more Breaking Bad adjacent TV, and Ozark is filling that for me nicely. And I get that.
It's those vibes. It's not as good as Breaking Bad, but it's, you know, it's playing in the same arena, close enough.
Sure.
You know, it gets knocked a lot for being a kind of clone of it, but I think it's doing its own thing enough where it's worth watching.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Speaking of unrelenting darkness, okay, so I wrote about how the show addressed the allegations against Jerry Harris over on my true crime newsletter, Best Evidence, last week. I will try not to repeat myself, but in brief, it did feel like a lot of the reaction to Cheers' second season on social media was along the lines of, wait, we're trying it with this again? In case you've forgotten, which, fair, it has now been over 2 years since the show dropped its first season on Netflix. The first season of Cheer followed the championship quest of the Navarro College, Texas cheer team. It was basically Last Chance U meets Bring It On, and the former comp is particularly apt, as it is the same production/direction team. And the breakout star of season one was Jerry Harris, who towards the end of 2020 was arrested on numerous counts of sexual misconduct involving underage members of the cheer community. Harris is, as of this writing, still detained in Chicago awaiting trial. The production of the show had, it seems, been proceeding in early 2020 until COVID canceled nationals, and then was still proceeding with some of those storylines until Harris's arrest in September of 2020. It's at this point that a lot of docuseries would have been like, the universe doesn't want it, called an audible and just put themselves on permanent hiatus. But Cheer moved forward, not just with a storyline about the new underdog, the rival Trinity Valley cheer team, and some of the athletes' found family narratives on that team, but also with the repercussions for the Nevero team of sudden white hot fame, quarantine and the pausing of everyone's lives, and of course, the allegations against Harris and the ripples outward from that. It is not entirely successful, this decision. This is a production that understands the vital road out role that college athletics plays for a lot of kids, and it takes them and their concerns seriously. So I had hoped to see more about that in terms of the effect of the COVID pause on these athletes. I had hoped to get a better understanding of their day-to-days in 2020, particularly since both schools are in Texas. The show spends too much time with the coaches comparatively, and Monica, the Nevero cheer coach, is not everyone's favorite. And the episode that faces the Harris situation full on does not come until halfway through the 9-episode second season, which overall is probably one or two episodes too long in the second place. But I do appreciate that they tried to do something. The show could have bailed on season 2, like I said, put a black square with "We Believe Survivors" text on its socials, and just turned its face away from Harris and his alleged crimes. But part of believing survivors is not doing that, especially if your production played a part in creating the star and the power differential that they then exploited. There's no universal way to address allegations like this about a central figure on your show. There's no perfect way to do this. Not every show with allegations against a central figure is going to be able to try to hold itself accountable. But Cheer tried. It put Harris's victims on camera, alleged victims, again, sorry. It made it clear the sport's governing bodies had done little to nothing about reports about not just Harris, but others. It let Harris's teammates be furious and betrayed and bereft. It could just as easily have been like, this isn't our job to set an example, but the show seems to feel that it is, and it did its best. And I think it's important that it was attempted, even if you don't feel like you have the stomach to watch it. I think that's also fine. But it's also still an amazing sports documentary show. It's shot beautifully. It's full of charismatic and talented people. It's interested in the athletes' journeys. It's interested in the class system created by and perpetrated by college athletics. If you would like to discuss any of this, or whether there is a more beautiful smile on this embattled planet than that of Jerron Hazelwood, understand there is not one. But I would love to talk about it with you. I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. And you can read my thoughts on Cheer Season 2 at Best Evidence. Most of that content is free. And that's at bestevidence.fyi.
So last week's episode, I was going to talk about the Book of Boba Fett. And now we're so far into it, I think I'm just going to wait until the end of it for a summary. But let me say this much about the Book of Boba Fett in relation to another show. In no universe before Book of Boba Fett started, what I thought to myself, I would have said this word. I'm getting more out of the show Peacemaker than I'm getting out of the Book of Boba Fett. And I fucking hated the Suicide Squad. I hated it. It's like worst movie of the, like.
It's very bad.
Yeah. Wait, which one?
The Suicide Squad, the James Gunn one.
There's two of them.
Yes, the Suicide Squad.
Oh, the new one, the James Gunn one. Okay, so the one that's from the same, okay. Yeah.
Suicide Squad is the first one. The Suicide Squad with the definite article.
Okay, so this is like a who's on first routine here a second ago with the definite article. I was second like, base. Oh, okay.
Peacemaker character in the Suicide Squad was just terrible. I mean, that movie was so mean-spirited and
disgusting,
but not in like a winky kind of funny way. Like, it just fell flat for me on almost like every level. And the Peacemaker series coming out after really felt like they should have looked at what they were doing with Peacemaker and then made the movie.
Yeah.
You know, like, it really feels like it's a good iteration on what was a shitty movie. John Cena as a Peacemaker is a really good, lunky performance. And, you know, they're giving him, you know, this anti-hero sort of redemptive arc. Mm-hmm. And it does work. It's super gross show as well. Like, there's a lot of gooey deaths and stuff like that. But it works better in context here than it did in the movie, for sure.
Yes.
And it's got a plot that seems to actually have, like, runway rather than the Suicide Squad, which is just complete nonsense to me. Mm-hmm. There's something in each episode where I just, like, I'm on the couch going, and I'm not getting that out of the Book of Boba Fett. And again, I'll talk about that after, but Book of Boba Fett's been really disappointing.
It was in episode 2 when they had the best Cinderella joke I have ever seen on television. Cinderella, the hair metal band from the 80s, where Peacemaker is collecting his hair metal LPs. And when he's trying to save them from his apartment, Tom Kiefer and the boys, perfect mix of blues and metal. And I, like, as a person who has had that exact thought, probably fell off the couch and died right
there. Uh-huh. There's an effortfulness in the Suicide Squad that is not here in Peacemaker. Peacemaker feels like the characters are very much at home in this weird, stupid world that has been created. In the movie, I felt like it was all just very forced. It was all just like people trying way too hard to make it work.
I'll say there's a moment in each episode of Peacemaker where there's a like the Joss Whedon tribute dialogue moment where you have to have the people comment on the thing and it goes on too long and it's not funny, where it's like, we're normal humans in this absurd situation, back and forth. You're saying this, I'm saying blah, 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 where it's like almost Sorkin-y, but it's the Joss Whedon version where it's like too much. Yeah. But I'm going to call out Freddie Stroma as Vigilante is so funny. He is my favorite thing about the show. He is hilarious. Like, every line does not miss. He was in a show on Netflix last year called The Crew that Kevin James was also in. Might have been 2020, actually, that was about NASCAR, and he was the driver, and he was like the dum-dum who's like the sweet idiot at the center of the show, and he was great in that too. Like, definitely the best thing about that extremely mediocre show. But here he's really hilarious, and a pretty good American accent for a British guy. He's pulling it off.
He's British?
He is British!
Oh, I feel betrayed.
Well, if you watched season 1 of Unreal, you may have seen him, because he was the bachelor in that season.
Oh, yeah.
He's that guy.
Oh, he was good in that.
Yeah, he was blonde there, so they dyed his hair. He's a brunette here, so that might be why he looks different. Also, the dorky glasses, but yeah. Freddie Stroma as Vigilante, hilarious.
Yeah.
Next, you're going to tell me that Eagly is a secret gummer.
Well, he's got the nose.
And since Mark is here and he did the Toast of London canon, I just want to mention Toast of Tinseltown. Mm-hmm. Kind of a disappointing season. Very uneven. They switched the setting from London to Hollywood.
Well, fake Hollywood.
Yeah.
Because of COVID.
Sure. Definitely is the worst of the seasons so far.
They're still funny in every episode, but yes, we flew to England to watch it, and it's coming to HBO Max this year.
It didn't make me laugh like the other seasons.
This hurts me deeply to hear
I know.
This.
Sorry. It's hard.
Gets me right in the ham.
Set your expectations. Yeah, it's no ham. And finally, let us quickly do.
The stars at night are big and bright.
We can come out of Texas.
All right, time for the 911 Lone Star Report. We're still in this stupid ice storm series. Yeah.
Oh my
terrible.
God, really?
I hate it. There's still. I said to Tara, this is the last one, right? Nope, another one next week. Rob Lowe is still either helping or capturing coyotes, and they're all bad. And now there's a dirty cop involved. It's just indomitable, and I hate it. Mm-hmm. And I need, when it comes back, if it doesn't make up for lost time with the craziest fucking shit I've ever seen, I may just suspend this for the season and just wait until it gets back to form, because I feel bad coming to you week after week telling you that we're still in potato flake snowland, and it's just not good.
What if he rescues Peter Coyote?
if we could just introduce like Wild E Coyote, Peter Coyote, just like all the pop culture coyotes into 911, even if they have to like fudge it and do it in a dream sequence, I'm there for it. They could save this. But
Ken Burns is making a documentary about the Rob Lowe character, and Peter Coyote is narrating it, because that's what he does.
I have to demand that you continue with this, because it is a public service, and that you will come on here, you will describe what is happening. Mm-hmm. I will go to Hulu and scrub to somebody falling into a volcano underneath a mini golf course and watch just those sections of the show. And without that, I'm not sitting through the whole
911 franchise would absolutely benefit from NFL red zone treatment. Like, it would be fantastic. Like, you just
2 minutes, Peter Coyote chokes on a scorpion.
We got the Johnny action, whatever the hell that, and then we get right into like people getting, you know, burned alive and whatnot. Fantastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk about what's coming up on this program on the next Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday. It is Back in Time TV. as Yellowstone is to 1883, we will then figure out what other TV shows need to go back in time and what that show would look like. And yep. then right here on EHG Prime next week, we're going to talk about Pam and Tommy with Dave Holmes. Yes, that Dave Holmes, the one from MTV. So don't miss that.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Erica S. It is called Mashed Debatos. And Erica writes, invite three TV characters over for dinner and discussion. One for a friendly debate, one for a discussion that starts friendly and turns heated, and one you go full scorched earth on for their dumb opinions. What do you talk slash fight about? And just for fun, what do you throw at each other first when the inevitable food fight starts? I will start us out. The subject we're going to be fighting about, I don't want to choose a topic that has real import in our current polarized discourse, but I did want to pick one that I have passionate feelings about. It's even already come up in this episode, cord cutting. So the person I would have the friendly debate with would be Guillermo de la Cruz from What We Do in the Shadows, because he time shifts everything anyway. He can't watch TV live. I see his point. In terms of starts friendly, turns heated, it would be Monica Geller from Friends, because she might try to make a very salient argument on fiscal grounds, and it would annoy me that she was not wrong. Also, we're so much alike, minor differences would be wildly magnified in a way that would make me mad over time. Mm-hmm. And scorched earth, Ted Mosby from How I Met Your Mother. We've definitely seen him watch TV on that show, but he is almost a I don't even have a TV guy. And since the events of the series, he might have become that guy fully. And the food thrown would be mac and cheese, because if I'm hosting, that's one of three dishes I can make. Mark.
Yeah, in the spirit of not wanting to wade too deeply into the heavier aspects, although this might inadvertently turn just as ugly, I decided to invite over for a discussion on, and this is also, Sarah might actually have strong opinions on this, is Star Tavern pizza overrated now that I live in Northern Jersey? Star Tavern is the bar pie capital of the area. It's a specific kind of pizza for those out of the region. It's the cheese kind of goes all the way to the edge. There's not much crust. Oh. Star Tavern is considered the quintessential example, and people are very ride or die for it. And the people I would invite over to have this discussion are, of course, Tony Soprano, Paulie Walnuts Galtieri, and Christopher Moltisanti. The more reasonable debate would start with Tony. You know, he's a pragmatic kind of guy. You know, yeah, it's good. It's good. You know, been there. Paulie would get increasingly agitated as I discuss, you know, maybe that's not my favorite kind of pizza. You know, I like a little crust. Maybe I like a Sicilian, thicker crust, fluffier, more on the focaccia end.
Sure.
And then going scorched earth with Christopher when I start to tell him that, yeah, Star Tavern's very overrated for what it is, and the best pizza is actually at Raza in Jersey City. And he starts telling me it's that hipster shit Neapolitan wood oven. And then, you know, we're things are flying. I'm being hit in the head with sauce. Mm-hmm. And it ends as many Italian family dinners do in this part of the country.
Fantastic. Well, I feel like we need to go straight to Sarah after that.
Well, I didn't have a specific topic picked out, but all of my dinner guests come from various editions of Law & Order. Mm-hmm. And so for the friendly debate about JFK assassination conspiracy theories, of course, I'm inviting Mr. John Munch from SVU / every other show.
Of course.
Because, first of all, he's actually not that much of a crackpot about some of this shit, as it turns out. And two, I'm likely to learn some trivia that I can use. The friendly discussion that turns heated is with Detective Robert Gorin of Criminal Intent, because literally every topic of discussion contains a well, actually, within the first 30 seconds from old Ben's at the Waste Management McGee. And eventually I'll just lose it on him because I can't with that. Like, there has to be one thing, one aspect of true crime trivia that I know more about than you, but no. And for Scorched Earth, obviously, That's Max fucking Greavy, who is the poster child for all cops are bastards and will behave unrepentantly in that exact fashion until, and quite possibly after, I wing a greasy room temp famous original raised slice at his pork pie noggin. It does seem like a waste of the pizza, but he brought it over and of course got pepperoni without asking, which I can't eat. Fuck that guy, Dave.
On the topic of the minimum wage. For a friendly debate, we have Woody Boyd from Cheers, who just talks about how, you know, he had his first job, but he got minimum wage, but he thinks maybe, like, people should be paid more in his very sort of Woody Boyd kind of way. It'll be a very gentle discussion about the minimum wage. For one that starts off as a debate and then goes very, very hot, very quick, we are inviting Malcolm Tucker from The Thick of It to go from a low simmer to a full rolling boil in about 10 seconds as the debate ends, as he just swears for 30 seconds straight and then says fuckity bye, and then that's all we see of him. And then for the scorched earth debate, because there are just some really dumb opinions in the room. And when I say dumb, I mean entertainingly dumb. And that's why I'm picking Johnny from Cobra Kai to come in for that part. And have all his stuck in the 80s views on capitalism and slackers and losers and people not manning up.
Nerds.
As really just the, you know, the end of the night. Little bonbon, and I believe everybody would enjoy throwing Hostess fruit pies. Because I'm not cooking.
Can confirm.
It is time for the canon presenting. All the way from Europe, this week is Mademoiselle Caroline with a pitch for The Mandalorian. Take it away, Caroline.
Hi, X-Trout. Great. It's Caroline here presenting Episode 8, The Redemption of the Great Star Wars Series, The Mandalorian. Because I love Star Wars, just like I love Harry Potter or Game of Thrones, I love this type of epic storytelling. And here, they're giving me more Star Wars on my TV, and it's great. This episode is the second part of the finale of the first season, and I am praying that the previously segment is clear enough for the non-regular watchers of the panel. It was directed by Taika Waititi, the great film director, and What We Do in the Shadows guy. He also provides the voice of IG-11 in this episode. So first of all, how cool is the intro with the fleeting images of the iconic masks and droids of the saga? So cool. Now, we start with a terrible, terrible scene involving Adam Pally and Jason Sudeikis, who are now dead to me because they kicked not once, not twice, but three times my precious baby Yoda, a.k.a. Grogu, a.k.a. the child, a.k.a. the cutest puppet this side of the Muppet Show. The scene is pretty cool despite this crime against all that's good and decent, because we hardly ever linger on stormtroopers like that. Plus, we see that they still can't hit anything with their blasters. The voice updates about what Moff Gideon is doing in the town are pretty funny as well. And then, da-da-da-da, IG-11 to the rescue! Killing them way too fast for my liking, but let's move on. Now, I've only chosen this episode because of Giancarlo Esposito and his stylish black cape. Maybe I needed something to draw in Tara and Sarah. So the heroes are trapped and surrounded by a ridiculous amount of baddies. Now, Moff Gideon is a man of traditions, so he's very verbose and allows plenty of time for the heroes to try and elaborate an escape plan like any good villain worth his salt. In the flashback, we learn more about how Din became a Mandalorian. How cool is the moment when the Mando finds him as a little boy with the sun in his back and that great guitar riff? But if you're still not convinced about this episode, put it on and freeze frame at 14 minutes, 48 seconds. The giddiness of the child as he's whizzing by, ears flapping in the wind. Then laughing and squeaking as IG-11 enters the town, killing stormtroopers left and right, like the badass droid that he is. Then, pew, pew, pew! It's the great Western scene. Everybody's shooting. Gideon manages to seriously hurt our hero and orders to burn them down. even though by then Grogu is with the heroes. And supposedly Gideon wants him alive and very badly. Moving on. Hey, Sarah and Tara, you get to see Pedro Pascal in this episode. Although I do not know if it's a plus here, the guy looks rough. He's been through some serious shit. Now, in case you thought the child wasn't doing enough by just being adorable, there he is, saving everybody from a fiery death with the Force. Now, for those of you who know me a little, you may wonder, she's been speaking for a while now, and she has yet to name drop Supernatural. Fear not. Here it comes. In the secret forge in the sewers? I don't know exactly how this could work. We meet the Armorer, played by Emily Swallow, a.k.a. The Darkness, on SPN. There, it's done. She gives Mando a cool signet in the shape of the Mudhorn, the rhino-like creature Mando and the child fought together back in episode 2. She also provides helpful exposition and lays the groundwork for season 2. So thank you, Emily. Finally, here we are in the underground lava river to provide a literary reference for all the bookish nerds like me. My, oh my, it's the River Styx. But then, we know that to survive crossing the River Styx, you need to pay a fee. And here comes the sacrifice. What a beautiful scene. R.I.P. IG-11. The droids are the best things in the Star Wars universe, in my opinion. They just rock, or in the case of BB-8, they just roll. Still need convincing? How about this last act? We get Grogu waving hello to Apollo Creed when he asks him to use the Force. Mando using his jetpack and taking Moff Gideon's ship down. Boy, did that healing spray work fast. Apollo referring to the baddies as the scum and villainy. Shout out to my man, Sir Alec Guinness. The Darksaber. Okay, this one had zero impact on me as I don't watch animated shows, so I wasn't aware of its meaning. Still, a great accessory to complement Moff Gideon's overall look. To conclude, Dave, help me convince the panel here. This is the way.
Thank you so much, Caroline. Mark, you chose this from our submissions. Please start us off.
I love The Mandalorian. I think it does correctly what two of the last three movies did in a way that made me actively angry about Star Wars things, especially the last one, which I have not rewatched since running out to see it in the theater, whenever that was. I mean, just terrible. It's so much fun as a show. It's like that perfect combination of like spaghetti Western meets the A-Team meets like Justified or something, you know, especially when you get into the second season and you've got some Oliphant action, which I think is actually maybe the best episode of the show. It might be a tie between this one and the Oliphant versus the Sandworm episode. They're terrific. I had actually just watched this last week with my son, who's 7.5 and now becoming a, you know, a little Star Wars enjoyer. He had gotten a Grogu for Christmas last year and didn't really understand what it was other than, you know, Baby Yoda is cute because we hadn't let him watch the show. And now he gets to see it and he sits and he watches it with me and he takes the Grogu and he puts it on the couch next to us. And it's like, it's the most adorable thing ever. And he feels bad that the stormtroopers are being just slaughtered. He's like, I feel bad. They're just cutting them down. I was like, it's okay. They're bad guys. And you know, most of them are clones trying to explain. But this was, you know, to finish up that first season, it did a really good job of, you know, taking it into the next season, what's going on with Grogu. The IG sacrifice scene is kind of a tearjerker for watching a robot, you know, sacrifice itself.
Yeah.
That turned into such a great character. You know, Taika doing the voice and it's great. And this episode was the best or maybe the second best of the two seasons, I think.
For a character that just stood still on the deck of the Star Destroyer in Empire Strikes Back and had an action figure that totally didn't articulate whatsoever, they did such a good job animating IG-11. I mean, it's not the same character exactly as IG-88 in Empire Strikes Back. Do not at me. But they did such a good job making it come to life. And then on top of that, you know, he's been reprogrammed. He's now a nurse droid, which I love the idea of a nurse droid. I just thought that character was like surprisingly effective at everything it did.
Yeah.
He's better than Boba Fett as a character, I think.
100%.
For two bounty hunters that didn't have a lot to do in the original movies, I feel more about him than I feel about Boba Fett in the Boba Fett show.
Yep. Agree. Caroline seems to be under the impression I don't watch this show, which I do. I'm even watching Stupid Book of Boba Fett. Probably would not if I did not live with Dave. But still, why don't you go next, then me, and then Dave can take us home.
I didn't continue watching The Mandalorian after we talked about it. It wasn't because I didn't like it. I just didn't. There's a lot of true crime, and I have to watch that first before things that are actually, you know, enjoyable.
All the problem is I couldn't manage to shoehorn in a Sarah Bunting character.
Well, yes.
Every show could
what
just
is,
do that.
What is she doing here? What do they need a pinko redhead teacher on this planet for? The previouslys were very helpful. What I kept thinking was that people like to make fun of button masher video games, but those are my favorite kind because they have their own pleasures. Like Tekken 2, I spent many, many 8-hour stretches mashing those buttons until like my thumb joint was inflamed. But if you mash them in the right order and you put together a killer combo, which is what this does, like it is mashing the fight button. It's mashing the like button with the stormtroopers. Like I agree with her. They should not be punching the baby, but like we live in the world. We know who the baby is and we know they're not going to get away with it. Also it's Adam Pally and I can't be mad. And then,
Ted Lasso would never punch the baby.
That's true.
But there's this moment, where Boba is like, oh, well, I'm not sad. And it's like, yes, you are. I'm a nurse droid. I'm programmed to understand that you're having this feeling. And then off the IG wades. And I was like, mm-hmm. Like, I just got back in here. I haven't been spending any time with these people. Gina Carano is a problem, maybe, right. With the acting. Like, this is not a perfect episode peopled by perfect performances. Like, sometimes I feel like someone had to, like, nudge Action Jackson awake. Like, maybe the drinking was not, like, fake drinking. But, it's all sort of works together. Like, they're mashing the sentiment button. They're mashing the action button. They're mashing just the right amount of Baby Yoda cuteness button, like when he's teething on this like magical amulet. And then he's like, all right, you keep that. Like they know exactly how much Baby Yoda to use without giving you the diabetes. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, it's very impressive. I did want to keep watching it. This was a delightful 48 minutes. And yeah, the only, like there are some minuses to it. Pascal does look real puffy, probably because, you know, in any other narrative universe, he has a fatal skull fracture and should be dying. Again, Carano, no. Like she can handle the weapons and during fight scenes, she's great. But when she's having to like disgorge a bunch of, not exposition, but just like, this is what, you know, the nature of Mandalorianism, like, don't give that to her, please. In fact, don't give that dialogue to anyone. But, Caroline, you're right. Esposito in a cape doing the talking villain thing and knowing he's doing it, but being like, I'm part of a storied franchise and I'm a professional. Like, even just that would have been worth it. And then, of course, he's cutting himself out of the thing at the end. And you're like, oh, yeah, like you don't hire that guy and then shoot him out of the sky. And that's it. Mm-hmm. Very satisfying. Excellent presentation. Baby Yoda is still unbelievably fucking cute. Well done. Like good sustain on that. Thank you for bringing me back to this show. It was a good time.
Yeah, Giancarlo Esposito is he's getting around the genre space lately. He's got a part in The Boys. He's a voice in Harley Quinn. He's did this. I forget if he dies in season two, but anyway,
he does not.
I don't have a lot to add because Caroline's presentation was so good. I did have a few tiny niggling issues with it. One was that if you're going to use a jetpack, don't have a cape. Like they tried. There were moments where when he was flying down, you could see it all wafting out.
I like to think it has those, you know, when you got curtains and you can get those little hooks you mount in the walls and they go in there? Or I feel like he should have those on his belt.
Or like people get for their pant legs when they ride a bike.
That's right, yeah, clips.
Same thing, uh-huh.
Cape clips.
Or just a Venetian cape that you roll it up.
Uh-huh. And a cape ducky.
Or he just like sticks it in the back of his pants, like just something. It would have been funny.
And his bum is all lumpy at the top. You can't help it. You just got to do it because he doesn't want his cape to burn because they're expensive.
He's got cape ass.
If anyone's ass can outact a cape, it's Pedro Pascal. That's and true. We all know it. I mean, fucking I know that's not his
Beskar
body.
Beskar ass.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Anyway, I don't know why there would be that huge pile of Mandalorian armor left. I guess we're supposed to think that she brought it back. Like the massacre didn't happen in the sewers.
I mean, it was a very effective visual, but
yeah,
if you pick it apart, you're right.
Like, also, that stuff's supposed to be so valuable.
That's
you
insane.
Think that they would have scavenged it. Yeah.
Yes, I would have thought that. Like, if she's the only one left, how did she get it all back there by herself? But anyway,
she probably called dibs.
Right. I also don't know why the vent to the sewer was so that big.
Like, so you can really smell it, so you know where it's coming from.
Right. And you know, she already said.
Oh, Dengar left one.
But Caroline already noted, like, what is this underground lava river? And why is there a fucking gondola in it? But, you know, whatever. It's, you know, it's fine. It's for the visual. I get it.
Well, the planet is all laced with, you know, the whole planet's like that. So I guess if, you know, those are your rivers, then, you know, you're going to use them at some point.
All right. Anyway, Caroline is right. The IG-11 story is extremely effective. Droids are the best thing in the Star Wars universe. I 100% agree. And
R2-D2 is the linchpin hero of this whole saga. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I agree.
Dave has been saying that for years, and he is right. And it's true that we, as Sarah said, we get just enough baby Yoda. He is so cute, and he's deployed the right amount to where you don't get sick of him. And like when we were watching the scene where the bag is opened and we see him for the first time in this episode, I said to Dave, oh my God, I forgot how cute he was, because there hasn't been Mandalorian for so long. Like every aspect of him, not just the huge eyes, not just the ears flapping in the wind when he's flying on the speeder, like his little hairs, like he's so cute.
The teeny little
fingers. It's the number one thing that should not work at all.
Yes!
And works perfectly.
Yeah. Yes.
Makes no sense. They've engineered it.
Well, it's like the cute overload principles of like proportion of ear size to eye size. It's like foot size. I mean, there's like an algorithm for this apparently. But
there is, yeah.
Like they opened the bag and I had the exact same response that I was like, holy shit, that's still the fucking cutest thing I ever saw. Cute. Like it's really amazing. Credit.
Yeah. So this is at the end of it. I said, yeah, this is a good choice. This is probably my favorite episode of the show. So great presentation, great selection. I agree with Sarah. Thank you for bringing it to us. Dave.
All right. I enjoyed this presentation because kind of like The Mandalorian, it kind of just felt like Caroline was in a sandbox playing with her action figures and having fun, which is kind of some of the appeal of The Mandalorian. Like The Mandalorian structure up to sort of the end of this season is just like fetch quest after fetch quest. If you get me this, I'll give you that.
Right.
And then you can get to the next thing. I found that a little tiresome after a while. And this doesn't do that at the end of the season. So I'm thankful for that. And this is why this episode stands out to me as the best of the first season. I do have a couple corrections. The Star Wars helmet thing is not cool. It's very cheap and shitty looking. And they really should use more iconic Star Wars music for that.
This is a correction, not a difference of opinion?
No.
Okay.
My question is, you suck.
Yeah.
Here we go.
Here is an actual correction. The stormtroopers at the start, played by Pal, are actually scout troops.
Yeah,
not storm troopers.
I knew that was coming.
I do enjoy the abbreviation SPN, like a part of the Hulu package or something. You know, it's
it's like VPN, but for supernatural.
One correction for Mark to scar his child. By this point in time, the stormtroopers are not clones. They're just people trying to make an honest day's dollar and getting killed for it. So,
what am I supposed to tell him, Dave? What am I supposed to tell him? How do I make mass murder palatable to a 7.5-year-old?
Listeners, with your suggestions, please explain in a kid-friendly way, you know, murder and genocide and et cetera, et cetera. And we'll pass that along.
I'm sure we're going to get suggestions. We have a whole Star Wars channel on our Patreon Discord, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people weighing in there. Great reason to join our Patreon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Patreon.com/extrahotgrade.
One thing Tara didn't mention that she did mention when we were watching it, and it was like my favorite thing of the episode, is Moff Gideon giving the ultimatum that you have to figure out your ship by nightfall. It's noon right now. Yeah. Why is he giving them 8 hours to figure their shit out?
Mm. And then he almost looks at the camera like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have to let them get out of this. Talk to you later.
That's a 10-second ultimatum if ever there was one.
Oh, yeah.
Come out with your hands up or we're going to start blasting. 10 seconds.
It's like Blofeld stopping the laser beam. It's like, we're just going to let this thing cool off for a little while before we singe off the genitals.
Yeah. And he's supposed to be like, you know, very surgical in his decisions and, you know, and it just didn't really track with his character.
Gus Fring just would have fried him on the spot.
But they also didn't need that much time. So I'm wondering why they gave him that much time in the dialogue. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, it really should have been, you know, we got to do it now kind of thing.
Also, at this point, they've already shot out the window. Like, presumably they can look through and see all the shit they're doing.
Throw a smoke grenade or something in there. Just smoke them out.
Drone. Yeah. You don't have drones? Yeah. Come on. You have drones.
They're also weirdly obsessed with fire as an armament. Mm-hmm. Mm. They have rockets and lasers, and they're like, how about some flamethrowers?
Yeah.
Yep.
It only goes 20 feet. Things get hot. Why use lasers?
Yeah, and it kind of made sense back in the days when Star Wars really just was like a World War II analog as far as technology goes. Yeah. Like, bullets don't have lasers, but everything's kind of the same. But since then, they've introduced like personal shields and stuff like this, things that would block the fire. Right. So you feel like fire would be even like less effective in sort of the, you know, the Disney era.
And that was their badass guy. They send in the special stormtrooper who's got his own red, you know, on the flamethrower guy armor. He comes walking up real slow with his giant flamethrower, shoots a little bit of flame in there, and then, you know, the baby was just like, right back at you.
All those stormtroopers were fans, so none of the, they didn't have enough uniforms, so they called up like the local stormtrooper cosplay group, and they all came in and shot
the Halloween store.
And that one guy came with his flamethrower get up at the summer of a video game, where that actually is like, that's the designation for that design. And they're like, all right, get flamethrower, let's do it. So that's kind of fun. Already mentioned IG-11, how I thought they did a really good job bringing that character to life. He is definitely my favorite surprise of season one, like beyond Baby Yoda's, like just seeing that like seemingly shitty, much like the Snowwalkers from Empire Strikes Back. Like, in what world would you actually design that for real world applications? A walking camel that can trip up and explode if you put a wire around his legs. Much in the same way IG-11 just seemed very impractical, but they made him actually seem super badass and effective, and I thought that was a really good turn for the show. I also really enjoyed the swole R2-D2 gondola guy, where he comes up and he's just like, he's got legs and a torso now. I thought that was really funny. Season one, I enjoyed much more than season two. Season two got way too fan servicey for me, and I felt like it got in the way of the story, or not in the way of the story, in the way of the fun. Season two was sort of a setup for stuff they're going to do combining all these shows right now. They're sort of doing a Defenders thing, you know, I don't really know if that's going to be some of its parts, but I really enjoyed the end of season one a lot. And I feel like this is probably the strongest episode for me. I'd also enjoyed the Timothy Oliphant one, but I think this one trumps it for me. So I'm going to probably say yes on this one. So let's put the official vote. Mark Lazanti, what say you, yay or nay?
Oh, big yay.
Sarah?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Ta.
Yep, same.
Right, me too. All right, that's a sweep. Woo! That means The Mandalorian Season 1, Episode 8, The Redemption. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Break In.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
I do. It's Amy Schneider, a winner in many different ways, but has now reached number 2 on Jeopardy's all-time wins list behind only Ken Jennings. Woo! Let's do it. Incredible.
And Loser of the Week?
Well, Loser of the Week is a show called Maggie, which was supposed to be on ABC, a TV network, and has just this week gotten kicked to Hulu.
ABC on Hulu?
No, just Hulu. I thought Maggie was just like Lady in the City sitcom, but it actually has like something of an idea behind it. I mean, idea in air quotes, but what it is about is a woman coming to terms with her abilities as a psychic. Okay. The reason that this is a loser of the week, not only for the obvious reasons, is that the star of Maggie is Rebecca Rittenhouse, who they're still trying to make happen. She had an arc toward the end of the Mindy Project. She was the very pretty blonde lady who was like made Mindy feel inferior. And then she also had a role on Four Weddings and a Funeral, the terrible Hulu TV series. And and so I was like, she's so unremarkable. She's only got failures in her wake. Why does she keep having chances? Is she a nepotism? Apparently, she is not related to anyone in show business, as far as I can tell, unless she also has changed her name and her Rittenhouse is her middle name, and she's
why
also
would
a gummer.
You pick Rittenhouse at this point in human history? I'm just saying
she came before the other one, but anyway, right. she is dating Chase Crawford from The Boys, which like I don't think that would give her enough juice to get all these shots. Tough luck to Maggie. Enjoy Hulu. Being cheek by jowl with How I Met Your Father, the terrible sitcom.
Speaking about, what was it? Tough luck? Is that what you said?
Sure.
Speaking about tough luck. All right, fine.
Speaking about cheeks.
All right, everybody. This is the 8th game time of the season. We are going to count the game time episode you did not hear because we can't play it with Tara and Sarah. So I feel like it was a fair matchup. Value Guess did win that one. So our season scores now are Tara 3, Value Guess also 3, and Sarah with 1. Woo. Today we are playing Mark the Halls from Dan Casino, who earns himself another extra credit topic.
Damn you, Casino!
All right, that was a lot of clips. Dan has given us a multiple choice quiz about the 2021 Hallmark movie season.
Oh, no.
Now,
fuck.
Full disclosure, he gave this to me in season near Christmas.
Okay.
But just the cards didn't go that way. But now, Christmas is forever, according to Hallmark. So I feel like we could play it whenever.
Well, this is our July episode. So it's Christmas in July.
Christmas in July. That's right.
All right, so that's really all you need to know. I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm going to give you 3 options. You have to tell me which one you think is the correct answer. 1 point apiece. No steel meals, obviously, because you're right or you're wrong. Yep. And there is 1 big round and a small little round at the end, dessert. So we'll play that one after that. All right, so let's throw it to Picky to see who will be going first today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right, we'll go Sarah, Mark, Tara. Are we ready to play Mark the Halls?
Sure.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Starting with Sarah D. Bunting. In You and Me and the Christmas Trees, Connecticut's resident expert on evergreens has to help a 4th-generation small town sugar house owner, B, a 4th-generation Christmas tree farmer, or C, a 4th-generation logger.
In the Christmas tree. C, logger.
Logger is incorrect. Christmas tree farmer. You and Me in the Christmas
Trees. Prisoner's dilemma myself out of that one.
All right, Mark, see if you can get your point on this question. This year's movies based on A Christmas Carol include all but which of the followings? Which one was not part of the lineup? Boyfriends of Christmas Past, A Dickens of a Holiday, or Debbie McComber's Mrs. Miracle, Ghosts of Home. Which one was not part of the Christmas Carol copycat lineup?
Please let it be the Dickens one.
That was part of it. We were looking for Debbie McComber's Mrs. Miracle, Ghosts of Home.
Wow.
All right, to Tara. On. No points yet.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas in Harmony.
Sure.
Involves a woman who is tricked into auditioning for a Christmas chorus led by her ex with predictable results. Mm. The harmony of the title is the name of the town, the name of the woman,
yep,
the name of the Christmas chorus, mm-hmm, or all of the above.
Oh, no.
Ew.
I'm just going to say the woman, although all of the above is very tempting.
You're correct. It is just the
ew,
name of
Christmas
the woman.
In Harmony? That's pretty...
Yeah, that's
who's
not
Christmas?
Okay.
That's the right question.
Yeah. Inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Really dickmas.
Back to Sarah. Time for them to come home for Christmas is about two people following a cryptic invitation to a small town Christmas festival. They are an amnesiac and her handsome nurse, big city cops undercover as a couple, or an adopted woman looking for her birth parents and a journalist writing about it.
I think it's a adoptive search.
What?
Amnesiac and her handsome
fuck
nurse.
Fuck off. Hallmark.
The characters at the center of Time for Them to Come Home.
Wow.
Adoption, 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 adoption.
I was with you, Sarah.
Yeah.
Back to Mr. Lazanti. Gingerbread Miracle has a couple finding love due to A, their attempts to win the gingerbread house contest in their Christmas-obsessed small town. B, a local bakery owner who might actually be an angel. Or C, a magical wish-granting Mexican bakery.
Oh my God.
In which one would somebody actually become a gingerbread cookie?
That's the sequel.
I'm going to go with the B again. I'm. This is a
local bakery owner who might actually be an angel is in fact not the
what?
Answer. It is a magical wish-granting Mexican bakery.
I'd just like to say before we continue that Tara and I have like a combined 12 appearances on It's Christmas Town.
Yeah.
With Dave Roth and Jeb Lund, my co-host on Quaid in Full. And I feel like we should be doing better at this, but...
Hey, I'm one for one. I'm doing fine.
Okay.
I would also say Mrs. Miracle was the first show that I went on to, the first movie that I went on that podcast to talk about. It wasn't Ghosts of Home or whatever that was. But it was a... it stars Doris Roberts as Mrs. Miracle. May she rest. We lost her. We miss her. Mm-hmm. But it was because the male lead in that is James Vanderbeek.
Wow.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well.
All right. See if you can get this one, Tara.
Okay.
What non-existent job does Jordan Sparks have in A Christmas Treasure?
Oh, boy.
Is it A, small town travel agent thinking of moving to the big city?
Sure.
B, small town journalist thinking of moving to the big city? Mm-hmm. Or C, a small town calligrapher thinking of moving to the big city?
Oh, no.
Travel agent, journalist, calligrapher.
Boy. Three amazing options. Dan really knows his shit, as usual. I'm going to say...
Really have the guts to go for calligraphy.
I can't. I want to, but I can't. I'm going to say... Oh, man. Journalist.
Correct. Ah!
It is always journalisming. Good job,
journalism people. Or marketing, I think, are the first ones that you go for.
Travel agent comes
experience.
Up a lot.
Hallmark has more journalism jobs than
it's true.
The rest of journalism combined.
It's true. All right, Sarah. In an unexpected Christmas, exes pretend to be a couple in order to A, surveil a suspected crime boss, B, share the last room at a quaint bread and breakfast after a blizzard, or C, avoid disappointing his family.
These are all extremely likely scenarios. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I feel like there has been sort of a surveillance one, but it was off the topic. I'm going to say bed and breakfast.
Incorrect, although you're right about the other one being another one. That is the Santa Stakeout is, in fact, the movie about
that's
the
not even the one crime. I was thinking of. It was like a side thing. It was like crossword. It wasn't a Christmas movie. It doesn't matter.
The answer was avoiding disappointing his family.
Classic.
Yeah, as
all
you
right,
do.
To Mark. Nikki DeLoach stars in 5 More Minutes, which has the same basic plot as The Notebook, but nominally inspired by A,
a Thomas Kinkade painting, B, a Scotty McCreary song, C, a poem by Jane Seymour, TV's Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman.
And jewelry designer.
And poet, apparently.
Well, according to Dan Cassino.
I'm going with the painter of light, Dave.
Painter of light, Thomas Kinkade is
correct. No!
It is a Scotty McCreary song. Dan Cassino continues to baffle.
Sadly,
and confuse
I knew that.
Oh my God. Wow.
All right.
Kill me.
Tara. This is the hardest test I've ever been involved with.
Yeah.
And the most telling, the one that searches deepest into your very soul.
Mm-hmm.
Tara.
Yeah.
A Royal Queen's Christmas centers on.
Redundancy? Yes.
Executive Tisha Royal coming back to her home in Queens for the holidays.
Oh, I see.
Two queens coming to look for the long-lost heir to the throne in a small Christmas-obsessed town. C, a prince coming to Queens, New York during Christmas and finding love.
Well, that's coming to America, so it's not that. I think it's the middle one.
Two queens coming to look for long-lost heir?
Sure.
Is incorrect.
Oh.
The correct answer is it is a clone of...
Coming to
the
America?
Coming to America plot.
Good Lord. Mm-hmm. I should have known that because they do have a P.S. I Love You movie that I'm seeing ads for during Late Night Frasers right now. So, fuck you, Hallmark.
Sarah. Making Spirits Bright, starring Taylor Cole, not the one that we know, I'm going to assume.
No, it's a Lady Taylor Cole.
We'll see.
It's not.
Has a familiar plot. Two scions of rival families in a small Christmas-obsessed town finding love during a competition.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the rivalry about? Is it A, who has the best holiday decorations? B, who makes the best maple syrup? C, who has the best Christmas tree farm?
Decorations.
Decorations. You're on the board.
Yay!
Yes. Sidebar, I was at HEB, the Texan grocery store, yesterday, where I found a new product called Maple Stream. It is an aerosol can of maple syrup that you can press, and it squirts maple syrup at a, you know, at a good trajectory into your pancake.
Your enemies?
Yeah. Is that a self-defense device?
You don't have to be right on top of your pancakes like some sort of sucker. You can be across the room with your maple stream.
As I said, maple stream sounds like a terrible urinary disease that you might get.
That's what Bernie Sanders got once.
It definitely sounds like some Edwardian malady you do not want. Oh, I got maple stream. You don't want that. Mark, a Christmas contest is about exes competing to raise money for charity who find they still have chemistry. It is a pretty rote setup for these movies, but fans were excited that it serves as a reunion for Shuri Appleby and Jason Baer from Roswell.
Sure.
Candace Cameron Bure and John Brotherton from Fuller House. Or Melissa Joan Hart and Nate Richert from Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Roswell, Fuller House, Sabrina are your options.
I'm just going to keep going down the middle.
Fuller House?
Fuller House.
Fuller House, you are correct.
Hey!
Nice.
Yes. All right, Tara.
Good old Candace, always a good choice.
Yeah.
Debbie Comer's A Mrs. Miracle Christmas has Caroline Ray as the titular Mrs. Miracle, who is legally distinct from Mary Poppins. However, she did not originate the role, which was first played in 2009 by A, Katherine Hellman, helping a cold-hearted executive Meredith Monroe, Doris Roberts helping widower James Vanderbeek, or Remington owns Stephanie Zimbalist helping lovelorn firefighter Chad Michael Murray. I think you know the answer.
I sure do. Doris Roberts.
Yes. Already gave the information earlier. Good thing you got that question. You would have been really mad otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in the game.
Sarah.
Yeah.
The nonsense plot of Christmas CEO is set in motion when a giant toy company sends its representative to a small town in order to shut down a small store selling handcrafted toys that infringe on its copyright. It's intellectual property. Got to protect it or you lose it.
That's right.
B, a toy company CEO shuts down her competition only to find out it was Santa Claus. Or C, a giant toy company wants to buy a small toy company and make the head of the small company CEO of the combined group. So is
happen?
It copyright shutdown, Santa takeover,
or combined and become the CEO?
I don't think it's that second thing because no one ever ends up in the big city in the end. So I'm going to say B, Santa.
Incorrect. It is the combine the companies and make them the CEO. And
then
they have to learn about love and business.
Come on. Guessing.
All right, back to Mark. This year's sequel to The Nine Lives of Christmas, starring Brandon Routh, involves A.
Superman's Brandon Routh?
Yeah, A seemingly immortal cat setting up couples who visit a bread and breakfast. Nine kittens who have been distributed during the holidays. Or C. A woman who seems to be in a coma but discovers the true meaning of life while stuck in the body of a cat.
Oh, I really hope it's C.
That is incorrect, and that is the plot of Disney Pixar's Soul. So if you want to see it, you can. But it has jazz, I think.
See, something. That's what it I does. Was responding to. Mm.
The answer is Nine Kittens Who Have Been Distributed During the Holidays. It is called The Nine Kittens of Christmas, if you want to look it up and watch it tonight.
Boo. You don't.
All right. This this is for Tara. Take us into our score break.
Okay.
The Miracle of Love, about a nurse who meets a guy while volunteering over the holidays, is the latest in a series of movies that highlight happy coincidences that might be some kind of supernatural intervention, giving the series its name. They are called Angel Breezes.
Oh, God.
Ew.
God Winks. Noel Nudges. I had a whole box of Noel Nudges on Boxing Day, and I was sick for that
Who's
whole week.
Who's been angel breezing in here?
That's what my grandmother would call a fart on Christmas.
Yeah. You eat too many Noel Nudges, you get the angel breezes.
Yeah. I feel like God Winks is too
blasphemous?
No, I think it's...
winky?
No, it's too gaudy. Okay. They would be more right. winky.
So is it Angel Breezes or Noel Nudges?
Dan, seek help for coming up with these two wrong answers.
Sarah, didn't you send us a box of Noel Nudges from Harbor Sweets here? They were delicious. Thank you so much.
Oh, God.
We still have a few in the fridge. I think it's Angel Breezes.
Sorry, I just hit the screen cap, Sarah. I'm leaving it there. Angel Breezes is incorrect.
No!
It is God Winks.
Wow.
It is the game you play with those little things. It's like Tiddlywinks, but, you know, on a higher plane.
Wow.
All right, is time for the scores.
Well, it's very close.
Yeah.
Mark and Sarah are tied with 1 point each. I have 3.
All right, you know, considering there was only one question where somebody actually knew the answer, that kind of tracks the score so far.
Yep.
All right, let's get back to Sarah. Oh, no, Sarah's gone. Sarah, if you can listen, about a woman discovering new biological relatives via a DNA website just in time for the holidays pretty much has to be called A, My Christmas Tree Family, B, My Family Tree Christmas, or C, My Christmas Family Tree. Once again, My Christmas Tree Family, My Family Tree Christmas, or My Christmas Family Tree. A, B, or C?
I mean, God Winks. Like, I mean, it should be C, but it's Hallmark, so I think it's B.
It's C.
No!
God damn it.
You can't outsmart these. Nope.
You can't outdumb them either. That's the problem.
It's like true. The slot experiment. It does, like, if you visualize it, it stops, you know, stops being measurable. So it's just a crapshoot.
Yes.
All right. This is question 17.
It's pretty.
It is for Mark. This year's premier African-American themed movie starring Olivia Washington really turns the normal formula on its head. In it, she's a corporate fixer who has to go where for our holidays? The picturesque small town where she grew up in Georgia, Paterson, New Jersey, New York City.
It's going to wind up being Paterson, but I'm going to say the small town.
Small town. Both of those things are incorrect. It is, in fact, New York City. It is called A Holiday in Harlem.
Wow.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark.
Should have been Paterson. I agree.
I'm being targeted.
Would have been cheaper. Tara.
Yep.
In Open by Christmas, Allison Sweeney has to find whom? a reclusive woman behind a famous Christmas poem, an anonymous writer of decades-old Christmas card, or a true author of a popular Christmas song?
Christmas card.
Christmas card, she says with authority. She is correct.
Yeah.
Open well by Christmas. What else would it be?
This is... We're back to Sarah. In Tis the Season to be Merry, Rachel Lee Cook is Mary, who goes to a small town of Vermont for the holidays in order to...
catch Maple Stream.
That just happens. You don't go there to do it. You get it when you go there. Track down an author of the world's best Christmas cookie recipe. Get ideas for her book on relationships. Collect Christmas traditions for her doctoral thesis in anthropology.
I need to know, just for my own health, is it Mary, M-A-R-Y, or M-E-R-R-Y?
M-E-R-R-Y.
You're welcome, Sarah.
What are the choices again?
Track down the author of the world's best cookie Christmas cookie recipe. Get ideas for her book on relationships. Collect Christmas traditions for her doctoral thesis in anthropology.
All equally plausible and ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Anthropology. Fuck it.
Ideas for her book on relationships. The most boring
That's
of all
second
of them.
Choice.
Yeah.
Mark, in A Christmas Together with You, Laura Vandervoot, that's fun, is on a holiday road trip in search of A, her father figure's long-lost love, B, the EMT who saved her after a car accident, or C, three men, one of whom is her father.
What was the title of it again?
A Christmas Together with You.
I'm hunting for the pun.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with B.
B, an EMT who saved her after a car accident, is incorrect.
God
her
damn.
Father figure's long-lost love is the goal of that road trip.
No hint in the title. No hint in the title whatsoever.
No.
Tara.
Flailing in the dark over here.
In Nantucket Noel, Sarah Power has to stop a developer from A, tearing down the lighthouse her family has minded for generations, tearing down the historic bread and breakfast that houses the town's Christmas show, or tearing down the wharf that houses her toy store.
Lighthouse.
Lighthouse is incorrect. Tearing down the wharf that houses her toy store. There is something diametrically opposed to the idea of wharf visual trappings and a Christmas special. I would never have guessed those two things.
I just want to also call out, Dave, every single time you've said bread and breakfast, and it's very cute.
Did I say bread? Well, that's what it is from now on, guys. Get used to it, because here we go.
Nantucket,
I mean, there is a lot of baking in these things. It's true.
Yeah.
8 Gifts of Hanukkah
is
Hallmark's Jewish movie offering this year.
So singular.
One. I don't know. However, our lead, played by Inbar Levy, doesn't get a traditional Hallmark lead occupation like baker or toy store owner. Instead, she's a certified public accountant, B, an optometrist, or C, a cantor at the local synagogue.
Wow.
What was the name of this thing again?
8 Gifts of Hanukkah. What do people know about Hanukkah we can put in the title? It's 8 or something.
Yeah. CPA, optometrist,
Cantor.
Cantor, I guess.
Cantor is incorrect. You had to see it was the optometrist all along.
Yeah, Cantor is too Jewish, I think.
Yeah. You want a Jewish person up there that in your headcanon you can believe is Christian still. That is how they get away with it.
Yeah.
All right, back to Mark in A Very Merry Bridesmaid. Emily Osment has to deal with her childhood crush coming back into her life while she's already preoccupied with A, her brother's wedding and her own 30th birthday, B, her mother's renewal of vows and a litter of 7 kittens, C, her younger sister's wedding and the town's Christmas baking competition.
God damn.
I mean, how do you choose? D, all of the above.
I was holding out for her own wedding because I need that drama.
But that's the sequel. That's why she's only a bridesmaid this time.
And also, then she's on one of the Wedding March movies where they still aren't Frenching. But that's anyway.
Right. If she survives this movie.
That's right. I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying this is what my thought process would be if this were my question.
Well, as I've proven over and over again, thought process has not been a reliable indicator. I'm going to go with the sister's wedding. Let's have the sister drama.
Sister's wedding and town's Christmas baking competition is...
Sure.
What?
Her brother's wedding.
Hilariously
and her
bad.
Own 30th birthday. She's getting old, guys. She's 30. Spanced. Will she ever find
Gross.
Love? Tara.
Yeah.
Getting towards the end of our first round before our little tiny second round.
Okay.
This year, we get two movies in the sister swap cinematic universe.
Classic.
In them, a restaurateur from Salt Lake switches places with her small-town baker sister mm-hmm. after the death of A, their lighthouse keeper grandfather, played by James Cromwell.
Oh, no.
Their theater-owning uncle, played by Kevin Nealon.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. Or their choir master father, played by Phil Collins.
Okay, I don't think James Cromwell would do one of these. And I'm certain Phil Collins would not do one of these. So it has to be Kevin Nealon.
Yeah. The only way James Cromwell would do it is if his daughter is like a director of these movies.
Exactly.
And that's her thing.
Oh, I got confused. It was like Kevin Pollack isn't in the Jewish one.
Phil Collins was much too busy being an alcoholic for the past decade to be in any of these. So
I think you mean an Alamoholic.
He can be two things.
That's true.
All right, Sarah. And every time a bell rings, three sisters in Mississippi return home to find that their dead father, A, set up a scavenger hunt around their hometown for their beloved family bell. B, has come back as an angel to help them find husbands. And C, left them a fortune that they have to give away before Christmas. So scavenger hunt, back as an angel, or a fortune they have to give away.
Was the father's name Clarence?
Probably. Okay. But we don't know.
Probably.
I don't have information.
Okay, the scavenger hunt sounds rad as shit. I would watch an entire series of movies based on that. So obviously that's not it. Obviously it's the give away the fortune.
Now, your answer is locked in, but do you want to reevaluate what has been the pattern so far? Which is when you say it can't be that one. It obviously is that one. A scavenger hunt around their hometown to find their beloved family bell was the current.
Do I have to watch that cheese now? I guess I do.
Was it B-E-L-L or B-E-L-L-E?
Oh.
Just like a ding-a-ling. Yeah. All right, Mark.
Angel Breeze.
And here's your last question, Mark. That was your last question, Sarah. Here's your last question of round one. In Christmas in My Heart, Heather Hemmons, that's fun. Not as fun as Vandervoot, but we'll get there. Mm-hmm. Heather Hemmons is a concert violinist who returns back to her small town after her father dies. Wow, a lot of dead dads. Once there, she, A, takes over the town Christmas concert while falling for the son of the developer who wants to raise the community center. B, helps a little girl prepare for a holiday concert while falling for the girl's father, a reclusive country music star. Or C, steps in to help the small town's failing symphony orchestra while falling for the daughter of the woman who used to fund the orchestra but has since died. Oh, okay, so your choices are developer son falling for them, falling for a reclusive music star, or falling for the daughter of the woman who used to fund the orchestra.
These are all great choices.
Which one is the one, though?
Yeah, falling for a woman is more Lifetime, in my opinion.
What are you trying to do to me here?
I don't know. I'm just, again, saying what my thought process would be.
Okay. All right, I'll try that one.
No.
I was going to go with B, but I'm going with Steve.
I'm going to give you the point. No, don't listen to Tara. You were correct. It was country music star. Tara is full of baloney.
That's what I'm saying. It wasn't C.
All right. Last question of round one to Tara.
Yeah. The villain of this game, apparently.
In the Latin-themed Sugar Plum Twist,
yep.
Jamie Gray Hyder is a big city lawyer moving her mom out of their family home, rediscovering the meaning of community, and falling for her childhood sweetheart.
Yep.
B, A successful cookbook author, home to collect more recipes from the community she had left behind and learning the real meaning of Latin cuisine. Mm. C, a ballet dancer home for the holidays, putting on a Latin twist on the local production of the Nutcracker.
What's the title again?
Sugar Plum Twist.
Nutcracker.
Nutcracker is correct, and that is round one. Very short round two coming at you.
I'd just like to note that actor was just written off of Law & Order Special Victims Unit.
Yeah. Hmm.
Oh, that's the real Sugar Plum Twist.
Yeah.
Tara, what are our scores here at the end of round one?
Well, they're less close than they were formerly. Sarah has one, Mark has two, I have six.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not sure who's winning there technically, really, overall.
I really have 1.5 generally. At best.
Who's to say what's going to happen at the end of this game? All right. Round two, who has been claimed by this year's Hallmark bottomless chum bucket?
Yes.
Here we go. For Sarah, who is not in the Santa stakeout? About undercover detectives surveilling the head of a town's Christmas committee. Not Joey Pants, Tamara Mowry Housley,
Rob
Van Winkle, aka Vanilla Ice, who is not in the Santa stakeout.
Tamara Mowry, not Tamara.
Tamara Mowry Housley.
Her. She's not in it.
She's in it.
She's in it.
Vanilla Ice, unfortunately, could not make the Santa stakeout.
Wow, him over Joey Pants. My God, I feel like both of those are
like, I knew Joey Pants was in it for some reason. I don't know why I knew that.
So not that Vanilla Ice wouldn't do it. He just wasn't invited. Mark, who is not in Christmas Sale, S-A-I-L? In which a daughter returns home to take care of her estranged father. Who is not in this? Katie Sackhoff, Billy Joel, Terry O'Quinn. Which one is not in Christmas Sale?
There's no way the Piano Man is doing this.
Correct.
Yeah!
You are correct. Billy Joel is not in Christmas Sale. Even though he loves to talk about fishermen, he's not in Christmas Sale. Tara.
Yep.
Who is not in train-based time travel movie? Oh, God. Who is not in the train-based time travel Christmas movie Next Stop Christmas? Is it Leah Thompson, Christopher Lloyd, or Thomas F. Wilson? Who is not in Next Stop Christmas, the train time travel Christmas movie? Oh my God. All right. Thompson, Lloyd, Wilson. Who is not in that?
Boy. Thompson.
Thompson. Leah Thompson is in it. So is Christopher Lloyd. Biff not returning.
Yeah.
Biff
is not returning.
Good for Biff.
Too busy with the April Fool's Day remake. All right.
Last question coming at you.
Thank God.
Sarah.
Okay.
Who is not in A Kiss Before Christmas about a guy who gets his wish to be successful but regrets it? Is it Marcia Gay Harden, Terry Thatcher?
Hatcher.
As soon as I said it. Terry Hatcher.
Bread and Breakfast Hatcher.
The Iron Lois.
Mary Lou Henner.
What was the last one, Dave?
Mary Lou Henner.
Mm. Okay, so Harry Thatcher, Mary Lou Retton. Who was the middle one?
The first one was Marcia Gay Harden.
Okay, Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher. And Marilyn Monroe. Harden, God. Hatcher, Henner. Like, I've said Christmas so many times, I have to stop myself in order to say Christmas correctly.
I'm going to say Hatcher.
Hatcher is, in fact, no, it isn't correct. Marcia Gay Harden, not in Kiss Before Christmas. Mark, here is your last question of the day.
Margaret Thatcher, Jesus.
Who is not in Christmas in Tahoe about a talent booker trying to save her family's hotel's Christmas show? Is it train frontman Pat Monahan, George Lopez, or Max Headroom himself, Matt Frewer? Who is not in Christmas in Tahoe?
It was Pat Monahan, Matt Frewer, and who was the second one?
George Lopez.
George Lopez.
George Lopez. Oh.
George Clooney.
The Peacemaker.
I just want to go with Max Headroom. I don't even think it's right.
Okay, you think Max Headroom is not in this, and you are correct.
What? Wow. I thought that, for sure.
He's got that Max Headroom syndication money.
No, but he's Canadian, so I thought if they shot this Tahoe one in like Banff.
They absolutely did.
The not original
Banff. It's Banff. Like, it's like the Reno to Banff is wherever they filmed it. You know?
Yeah.
Famph.
You know.
All right, last question. It is for Tara. Here we go. Who is not in One December Night about rival music managers with aging rock star dads?
Okay.
Who is not in this? Chris Elliott, Bruce Campbell, Peter Gallagher.
Chris Elliott.
Correct. He was not in One December Night. And that is regulation. Let's get the scores.
That was really hard. Dan, you are crazy for this one. Yeah. Sarah finished with one strong point. Mark had four, and I had seven.
All right, that means Tara is both the winner and the loser today.
Yes.
Tara.
Oh.
And in celebration of Tara winning this terrible game, I mean,
Angel Breeze the victory.
It's a great game, but you won it, and that's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
And giving everybody else the steel meal today.
Nice. Good
job. For not knowing about all these Christmas movies.
That is correct.
Oh. Nice to know some good could come of that.
That is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We accepted the invitation to watch the HBO show The Gilded Age before going around the dial with stops at American Auto, Abbott Elementary, Ozark Cheer, and Peacemaker, Tinseltown, and 911 Lone Star. Erica had us debate a few TV characters at dinner, and Mademoiselle Caroline managed to hit her target with a canon presentation of the season one finale of The Mandalorian. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Mr. Dan Cassino. Next up, it's Back in Time TV on Extra, Extra Hot Great, and on the next EHG Prime, it's Pam and Tommy. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I guess send 200 lobsters to the church.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Angel Breeze isn't a race, it's a creed.
And Mark Lazanti.
For a New Yorker, anything is possible.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Hey, let's make the baby do the magic hand thing. Come on, baby. Do the magic hand thing. I'm out of ideas.
I was actually going to do that as my outro.